Hi, I'm Dr. Pam Peake, and welcome to episode 190 of Her, the podcast where you'll hear the naked truth about her mind, her body, her life, and oh boy, his anatomy today. That's right. We have a repeat performance by our go-to urologist, Dr. Aaron Spitz. This is going to be a terrific show. And just know that this episode is made possible by our wonderful friends at Smarty Pants Women's Vitamins, the delicious once-a-day gummies that contain all of the essential vitamins, minerals, and omega oils customized just for women. To learn more, hop on over to SmartyPantsVitamins.com. And here's your official first reminder to click on iTunes after this episode to rate and review the show, because I just sit here waiting to hear your feedback. You heard me right. Waiting. Oh, my goodness gracious. Let's get going. All right. It's time for Her.
Her. The podcast.
The naked truth about women.
Her mind. Her body. Her life. It's all about her.
So, oh, well, here we are. I'm holding a book all of you should be holding. This is just the best. It's got a big, wonderful purple eggplant on the cover, and it's called The Penis Book. Yep, you heard me right. And it was written by Dr. Aaron Spitz. Now, Dr. Spitz is our go-to urologist. He's also one of America's top urologists. He serves as a chief representative for urologists to the American Medical Association, as well as immediate past president of the California Urological Association. Good heavens, he's all over the place. He served as assistant clinical professor at UC Irvine's Department of Urology, and he's been all over television, including The Doctor's Show. Aaron, welcome back to the Her Podcast.
Oh, wow. It's so fun to be back here. And I really appreciate the opportunity to share some of this hidden information with your listeners. So, really looking forward to diving into this topic with you some more.
Well, I want to share a little bit of our conversation we had before we started doing the podcast. And that is, when you're at a party, you're socializing, whatever, and maybe your book's sitting there, you know, it's a coffee table thing or whatever. What goes on with men and women when they see the book?
You know, it's really interesting. Even though this on the cover is obviously a book for the male anatomy, I find that women just are so enthusiastic and excited about getting their hands on this book, more so than the guy. So when I'm at a party and this book pops out, as it often does, I will
we're going to be full of this.
Yes, right. The women will grab it more than the guys. I mean, maybe the guys are a little self-conscious because, hey, maybe just looking at this book implies that maybe you need this book. But nonetheless, women are excited. They'll grab it. They'll grab it from each other. They'll dive right into the chapters that look the most, I don't know, relevant to them or the most mysterious to them. And they will laugh and they will just really be very amused and informed. And it's amazing how they responded. When I wrote the book, I knew that this would be a book that was relevant for both sexes, but you know, I figured it was, you know, primarily relevant for my male audience as a urologist. Most of my patients are men. But I've been so gratified to see how well received it is by women. And it just goes to show you, you know, how really interconnected we are, men and women, and how what we do, our health, our function is really a team effort. And you really see that in the way both men and women respond to this.
You know, as a urologist, you know, in this case, obviously a male urologist, when guys come in to talk to you about their, as it were, you know, penis health, their, you know, gonadal health, I guess, are they pretty forthcoming or do they kind of stare at the floor a lot? Do you know what I mean? Like when a woman is talking about her, you know, gynecological issues, usually the grand majority of women will just sort of let it rip, you know? what happens between you and a guy in that office?
Yeah, you know, you raise a great point. Men and women are typically very different when it comes to representing themselves and their own health care. In fact, the guys are usually brought in by their wives or their female partners, because women are just so much more attuned to their bodies. Maybe it's cultural, maybe it's just inherent in how men and women are, but they know that it's important to address issues. Men really have to be pushed and prodded, and the same is true when they're in my office talking to me. In many cases, the guys are there for their sexual function, but what they write down on the intake form is that it's about maybe a urination issue. And then maybe they have a urination issue as well, but that's not really the main reason they're there. They'll sit down, I'll talk to them about their stated problem, the urination issue. We'll go through the whole thing and I'll examine them, prostate check, the whole nine yards. And as we're wrapping up the visit, they'll say, by the way, comma, dot, dot, dot. And I know what that means. and after years of practice, I already know that's coming. And so now I won't even force them to have to go there. I'll bring it up. I'll raise the issue with them, even if they're not raising it. And these days, more and more of my patients are more comfortable, or they've already gone through that whole charade with their family doctor, and now they're here to see me finally. So I know why they're there. They know why they're there. But, you know, for a lot of guys, it's still this you know, shameful feeling. And I will elicit that question, whether they're there to see me or not. And so often, the guys are relieved that I brought it up, even though they couldn't.
Oh, I love the way you approach that. Yeah, that whole issue of the shameful thing, which is kind of interesting. I would imagine that, you know, having an issue like that really affects a guy in a big way, because, you know, I mean, they're supposed to be, you know, studly, and, you know, there's that whole stereotype of the male guy, you know, kind of being the strong one and all the rest of it. And then there's sexual issues. It could be premature ejaculation, which you talk about in your chapters. I must admit, the titles of your chapters, I don't know, did you have like a little wine in your hand or something when you came up with these things? I mean, they're just hysterical. Chapter 2, Come and Get It.
Thank you.
Ejaculation and orgasm. You know, but I don't know. It's sort of like that whole issue of embarrassment, kind of shame. I would imagine that on the two ends of the age spectrum, if you're young, aren't you supposed to be like at the top of your, you know, game? And then maybe something's coming up. But I would imagine as you age, certainly I've read some of the literature about guys, you know, age 50 and over, who, you know, are having, would you say the majority are having something up with the sexual dysfunction?
Yes, that's a really accurate characterization. At least half of guys at age 50 have some degree of an issue with their sexual function. And as you said, embarrassment is a real problem. You know, obviously it's largely cultural, but it's also due to a lack of information. I think that so many people don't understand how physical sexual response is, and they take responsibility and guilt and shame for their sexual dysfunction when it's really a physical, a biological issue that is not their fault. And their partners often take responsibility, thinking that they are no longer desirable, or perhaps their mate is having an affair, or there's some other behavioral, psychological reason for what is typically a physical issue, particularly when you're talking about that age range of 50 and older. And then with the younger age guys, like my son's ages, you know, late teens, early 20s, the shame and embarrassment often comes from misrepresentation of what normal is, typically through pornography or just through, you know, pop culture. Once you understand what normal really is, then a lot of the shame falls away. And once you understand how much of this is really physical and why, a lot of the shame falls away. And not only that, understanding the physical causes of sexual dysfunction and understanding that they are so intimately linked with the physical causes of other illnesses like heart disease, diabetes, high blood pressure, all of those so intertwined. Yes. So once you understand that there's a physical link there and you can reverse it or you can address it, not only can you get back to a happier, healthier sexual life, but you can also get back to a happier, healthier life in general and start addressing a lot of different health issues because they're all connected there. So, you know, information is key. That's what this book does. That's what your podcast does. And also just being aware that you're not alone. You know, a guy walks in age 50, he's having some problems with his erections. He doesn't realize that I've got four other exam rooms with guys just like him with the exact same problem. Guys feel isolated and alone because they're not going to show up at work and say, hey, Jim, oh, man, I really had trouble this weekend having sex with my wife. What do you think about that?
Oh, yeah, right over the coffee pot in the employee room. Yeah, right.
That's right. And I think perhaps women share a little bit more than guys do, and they don't feel quite as alone in some of these things. But you know, you can feel very isolated and shameful as well.
Well, you know, how many guys then just withdraw from sex altogether?
Well, you know, I do see that. I see that typically in the later years, but sometimes surprisingly earlier than I would expect. I mean, it's not
really
uncommon as men get very towards the end of a typical lifespan to kind of shut things down. You know, guys in their 80s or 90s, but there's still people in their 80s or 90s that are sexually active. But, you know, sometimes I'll see guys in their 60s, in their early 60s, and they say, well, you know, I'm getting older now, and I figure it's probably just natural that I'm not having sex anymore. That's really not the case. I mean, that's kind of early to check out. But it's in some ways a defense mechanism. And in some ways, it's because they're just simply not aware that, hey, this actually can be managed. This actually can be turned around. And in fact, in some cases, quite easily. So yes, people do that. And for some couples, though, it's a very reasonable response because there are some couples for whom there are issues with the woman's anatomy, maybe due to previous cancer or other conditions where surgery was required or conditions where penetrative intercourse is no longer able to be accomplished without a great deal of discomfort. And so transitioning to other forms of sexual play that don't require a rigid penis becomes a natural part of the sexual interaction. And in those cases, seeking out treatments for a rigid penis is not so relevant and is not so, and it's reasonable to make that kind of adaptation. And I see that and I respect that, certainly.
So of all the guys who are like kind of 50 and over, what do you typically do? You know, what's your algorithm for dealing with their sexual dysfunction?
Well, first of all, I let them know that it is not likely to be psychological because most of the guys coming in at that age range think it is psychological and often so do their partners. And there's a lot of distress wrapped up in that in the relationship, as you might imagine. And so just putting that on the table right up front that, look, this is likely more physical than psychological takes away a lot of the anxiety and a lot of the shame. Now, that's not to say that there is no psychological component. Certainly, there is a psychological component because you can't help but react to your own physical situation psychologically, but it's not the primary component. Then we look for, okay, what are the underlying physical problems that could be at play that we should make sure we recognize and not let go untreated and then possibly improve? The condition of one's blood vessels, how well those blood vessels can pump blood to the penis, is the primary issue behind erectile dysfunction. And there's a lot of things that can lead to poor blood flow. Diabetes, high blood pressure, elevated cholesterol. These are all things that we look for and check off the list. And if they're at play, try to correct. Untreated diabetes, once treated, can result in some improvement in sexual function over time. High cholesterol, once treated with diet, exercise, or in some cases, prescription medicines, also can result in improved blood flow and erections, again, over time. For many men, It's a matter of modifying their diet and stepping up their exercise. Blood flow to the penis is really very affected by diet and exercise, but more so diet. Diet really seems to trump a lot of things over exercise, including weight loss and a lot of the other conditions such as high blood pressure and heart disease. And the same is true with erectile dysfunction. And I try to get guys onto a diet that is basically plant-based, as much as possible, moving in that direction of a plant-based diet, trying to minimize or eliminate animal products, processed sugars, and pretty much trying to eat straight out of the produce section, because these kinds of foods have thousands of wonderful molecules in them that are good for our body in a variety of ways, including nitrites that turn into nitric oxide. Nitric oxide is this key molecule that improves blood flow throughout our body and is the key molecule that is released when we're going to have an erection to stimulate blood flow to the penis. And if you eat a diet that is rich in molecules that will stimulate your nitric oxide and in molecules that help the health of your blood vessels, that's going to be key to your erections. It's not a quick fix, but it is a way to sort of gain back what you've lost over the years. And amazingly, we don't think of ourselves at all that old. I'm 51. I don't think of myself as old. But starting in our 30s, our blood vessels start to deteriorate because we start making less and less and less of this nitric oxide for our own blood vessels. And so we need to eat smarter to try to replace it. And when we exercise, we also induce a release of nitric oxide as well as other excellent chemicals for our blood vessels. And then there's supplements too. Some natural supplements, in addition to the good foods, can help boost nitric oxide. And one in particular that I'm actually a spokesperson for, but one that I believe very strongly because I think the science behind it is quite strong, is based on ginger. It's a supplement called Revactin, and it's a combination of ginger, L-citrulline, which is an amino acid that becomes L-arginine, that then becomes nitric oxide, and a couple of Brazilian plants called Guarana and Marapuima. And these have been shown to boost the production of nitric oxide in blood vessels, which increases blood flow. But also another really cool thing about boosting nitric oxide in our blood vessels is it works to counteract the aging and deterioration of the blood vessels through the mitochondria. It actually restores youth to the blood vessels. And I've started recommending this supplement to my patients, and they're starting to give me some really positive feedback about increased flow to their penis, more responsive to pills if the pills weren't working as well. But I think of it also as just good for general health. If you can eat in a way that boosts your nitric oxide, exercise, and consider supplements, and understand that this is a natural deterioration that starts as early as our 30s, that's a way to either stave off the erectile dysfunction by age 50 or to start to reverse it by age 50. So,
well, you know, a lot of guys who are in this, well, wait a minute, a lot of guys who are in this population, yeah, right? Because you mentioned it, yeah, really looking to maintain their, you know, kind of youth. They're taking good care of themselves, exercise, mm-hmm, and otherwise. And, you know, you've seen the low testosterone advertisements everywhere. You know, do you have low T?
Yes.
And,
yes,
and back and forth. And a lot of guys now are actually taking testosterone. I mean, the real thing. How does, yeah, that impact on sexual function?
Well, you know, testosterone has been overhyped, but then it's also been over-criticized. So I, uh-huh, do screen my guys for low T if they're complaining of erectile dysfunction, because there will be a certain percentage of those guys at age 50 that in fact do have low testosterone, and that's playing a role in their erectile dysfunction. And if a guy complains of poor erections, that actually scientifically is reason enough to go and check their blood levels. But we don't just guess. We check the blood levels. We verify that it's actually low before starting testosterone. That's where the criticisms come in. Too many guys show up saying, hey, I think my T is low, or I think I could be stronger, better, faster, and put themselves on T either through the gym or some back, backdoor way, or through physicians that perhaps aren't as careful about prescribing it, even when their testosterone level was normal. And that's a disservice to themselves, because when you go on testosterone, it shuts yours down. It puts yours into hibernation. that's fine if you need it. But if you don't need it, you're trading your own normal levels for having to pay for a replacement that's really not going to be doing you any good. Testosterone doesn't turn you into Superman if your levels are already normal. But if your levels are low, and some guys really are, boy, it can make a world of difference. It may not be the only thing that is required to bring your erections back, but it is certainly part of the equation, because even pills like Viagra, Cialis, they won't work so well on a guy whose testosterone is low and not brought up to normal. So yes, low testosterone is a real factor. It's not as prevalent as everybody thinks it is, and there's a lot of guys who are on it unnecessarily. But for those guys that need it, it's an important part of the treatment. And that's one of the things that we'll evaluate in that guy who's sitting right in front of me.
So how many guys do you have a conversation with about Viagra and Cialis? I mean, you know, first of all, tell all of our listeners, what are those medications? What do they do?
Yeah, so Viagra and Cialis are medications that harness the body's own nitric oxide and allow it to work more profoundly. It's almost like a turbocharger, if you will. When you have an erection, what's happening is there's a nerve signal coming from your brain, also coming from your penis if it's being stimulated, that results in nitric oxide being released from the nerve into the little blood vessels that are inside your penis. And that nitric oxide results in this other molecular reaction that causes blood to rush into the penis, because those blood vessels are opening up, they're stretching and relaxing. And that lasts for a certain period of time, and then another reaction comes along and shuts it off, kind of like a rheostat. You know, when you turn on the heat in your house and you set it to 72 degrees, the furnace kicks in, and once you hit 72 degrees, the thermometer tells the furnace to shut off. Our penis will get an erection, and after a certain period of time, it'll tell the body to shut it off, so we don't have an erection indefinitely. And so what Viagra and Cialis does is it stops the shutoff. So it allows the nitric oxide reaction to stay on longer before the body is able to shut it down again. And the reason that helps a guy who has trouble getting erections get an erection is because if his blood is flowing in slower than normally, but that reaction is still shutting off at a certain time, if you can allow more time for that blood to flow in, you're going to have a better erection, even though your underlying blood flow is weak. So Viagra and Cialis are great tools to get a guy back in the saddle right away while he's working on the nutrition and the exercise and the supplements to make those blood vessels inherently healthy, which takes a much longer period of time. And the great thing about these pills is that they are so safe, and they are in no way harmful to you unless you are on nitroglycerin. If you are on nitroglycerin, the combination of the pills and the nitroglycerin can cause a profound drop in blood pressure in your heart arteries. That's the risk. But if you are not on nitroglycerin, they are not bad for you. In fact, by allowing the nitric oxide to linger longer in your blood vessels, they also have a little bit of a rejuvenating effect on your blood vessels. So they can be used at will. They don't make your body dependent on them. They don't ruin you. You don't have to then use them from that point on. They can be used very liberally, but they should be, of course, prescribed under the supervision of a doctor. But I introduce Viagra and Cialis very early into the conversation, and I invite men to go ahead and take them as long as, you know, there's no contradictory reason that they can't.
You know, it's interesting, as you've been talking, it occurs to me, for quite some time, there were a lot of those TV ads and otherwise for Viagra and Cialis. They were very provocative and back and forth. I haven't seen those in quite some time. What is there, either disinterest, or is it pretty well, you know, kind of a given that at some point you're going to be popping these pills?
No, there's a very specific reason why you don't see those ads anymore. And that's because the pills have gone or are going generic. So the owners of the patents, the manufacturers of those branded products, no longer are incentivized to spend that kind of marketing money on them. It's just that simple. And that's the same reason that I no longer have samples in my office. It's just because they've transitioned to generic. So now you can get generic Viagra. And I'm starting to see people getting generic Cialis at certain pharmacies, which is great news for people who had restrained themselves from seeking care because they figured it was just too expensive. And boy, those pills were really expensive. And now they're not so expensive. And so the very reason you don't see the commercials is the same reason why it's easier than ever to start getting treated.
Does insurance pay for the medication?
Some insurances do. And now that there is generic versions, increasingly we're seeing coverage for it. But even without coverage, the price point for the generics can be affordable, even if a person had to pay out of pocket. I'll give you an example. Before generic Viagra itself came out recently, one could get a version of it, which is called sildenafil, at a lower dosing. Our typical Viagra is 100 milligrams of sildenafil. You could get 20 milligram tablets generic for about a dollar a pill. And most people need 100 milligrams, but some only need 20, some need 50. And so for, you know, $1 to $5 a dose, you could have access to the same stuff as branded Viagra. And that's with no insurance coverage whatsoever. It's not no money, but it's not terribly expensive. And hey, after all, who said you can't put a price on love, right?
So, I knew you were going to say that. I knew we were going to finally devolve into that at some point in time.
Oh.
So how long does the erection last? There are so many, yeah, you know, double entendres and puns and stuff. I'm going to try to avoid most of those. But how long can someone expect for the erection to last? I mean, is it age dependent?
Well, you know, as men get older and their circulation gets weaker, their erections will not last as well. Now, an erection should last until a man climaxes, because climax causes a release of adrenaline, and adrenaline shuts down the flow of blood to the penis, because adrenaline is there to increase the blood flow to your vital structures, your heart, your lungs, your brain, to deal with stress, but it's also to make the erection go away when you're all done and you've climaxed. So that an erection lasts as long as you are having sex until you climax, and that's a variable for different people, but on average, most people are having sex until they climax for a period of about 5 or 6 minutes, okay? Contrary to what might be depicted in pornographic videos of acrobatic sex,
that's right,
you know, lasting indefinitely, it's typically about 5 or 6 minutes. But as the blood vessels get weaker, men find that they're not able to maintain their erection until they climax. Pills like Viagra and Cialis will help a man last until he climaxes in the majority of cases. So can nutritional supplements such as Revactin or the combination of the two. These are all working on increasing the flow of blood, but the erection ideally should last until you reach climax, and then you have that other signal that then shuts it down.
Huh. Okay. Now, as we're kind of, I mean, this has just been really, really interesting. I feel like we're kind of sitting in your office, getting an earful here on what really transpires there behind the doors. Because women want to know, we just want to know. Well, so when should a woman, I mean, maybe it's just sort of like, I don't know, a little awkward or uncomfortable for a woman sometimes to bring this up with her, you know, partner, but when should she recommend that she see a urologist? What are some of the little warning issues that might prompt a nice little visit to your office?
Sure. Well, I think whenever a man experiences some sexual dysfunction, of course, it could just be an off time, something threw him off. And, you know, a single episode of erectile dysfunction does not necessarily warrant a trip to the urologist's office or to the doctor's office. But, you know, if this happens a couple times, then pay heed and go ahead and suggest to your partner that he get evaluated. Now, different people have different access to urologists. Not all people can just go to urologists directly. Some need to see their family doctor first and then get a referral. And I think it actually is wise for a man who has some erectile dysfunction to see their primary care doctor, their internist, their family doctor, because not only is erectile dysfunction typically a physical problem, but that physical problem may be the tip of the iceberg for other more life-threatening situations. Erectile dysfunction is often the first warning sign of heart disease. And for guys that don't get in and see their doctor regularly, which is true for most guys, when they have erectile dysfunction, if they recognize that and get evaluated, they may then have heart disease or diabetes evaluated at that time and then start to get under treatment, not realizing that they were suffering from these conditions. And so a couple episodes of erectile dysfunction would be a good reason to have your partner get in and see their family doctor, but also if they have access to get in and see their urologist. Most family doctors are now able to prescribe, understand enough to prescribe Viagra and get a man started with their sexual function. But ideally a urologist is going to be able to give, of course, you know, the highest level of expertise. But just as importantly is for that person's primary doctor to rule out diabetes, rule out heart disease, and treat it if it's found.
Well, that's exactly why I brought this entire thing up, because it oftentimes is the first sign of heart disease. And if, you know, with for all intent and purposes, diabetes rampant out there, and heart disease being so, interrelated with diabetes type 2, it's really important that people don't just blow this off, that there may be a very significant underlying disease going on. And this, as you said so well, may be the first manifestation. So there you have that. I want everyone out there to know in her podcast land that we have been talking to Dr. Aaron Spitz, and he is our go-to urologist and the author of a book. Seriously, if you don't have this, listen, you want to have a really cool party out there, girlfriends, then just grab the penis book, right? And throw it on a coffee table and let's just have a party. Because watch what happens. First of all, someone's going to try to steal it. So you should probably chain it to the coffee table. But this is just a fabulous, complete guide to all things men's penis health, from size to function and everything in between, as the subtitle said. Aaron, thank you so much for being on the podcast. Once again, I'm just sitting here taking notes furiously, and I know for a fact that our large listening audience out there is sitting there saying, whoa, just got answers to some seriously important questions. Aaron, thanks for being on the Herb podcast once again.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you, Pam.
Awesome. And everyone out there right now, take a minute to hit iTunes, rate and review the show, because we want to hear your feedback. This was such an excellent, awesome, provocative, amazing, informative episode. So run on over to iTunes right now. All right. I'm Dr. Pam Peek, host of the Herb Podcast. Follow me on Facebook at Dr. Pam Peek, or Twitter at Pam Peek MD. And remember to catch every episode of the Her Podcast on iTunes or Radio MD. Thanks for listening today. And hey, stay well.